We're planning on doing another television program tomorrow, although this will not be seen on WGN. Mark, what were the letters for the other stations?
We had approximately another 120 telephone calls from the other
stations. Yeah. I think this little thing here is bent and won't stay on. Let me just see if I can get it fixed right quick. It won't stay on my tie. I'll have to put it on my jacket. There we go. If you do a little quick calculating, I think you'll find out that those 300 calls cost us at $4,500 for a half an hour, somewhere around $13 a piece. Believe it or not, that's not bad. We used to use a criterion in the CGI of $30 as a cutoff point. And that sounds awfully expensive, doesn't it? In a work where you are giving away the truth and the knowledge of God and a witness and a warning message, and you are never asking for money or soliciting funds at all, which is almost unheard of on anything they would call television evangelism, then it is a shocking statistic to say that the raw figure of simply dividing the number of new calls per new response, not other responses, by the amount of dollars you pay just for the airtime, which is not an accurate way of looking at it, and then saying that anything around $20 or under $20 is a bargain for us is really interesting. It shows that God's people are willing to give and give virtually till it hurts to make sure that one human family, one life, one family, one human being, probably a couple or the head of a family, sees the program and gets interested enough not only to feed from the program. Many thousands of people do that who never call us. And they are educated, they are learning, they are growing, they are getting information from the program, and we never hear from them. But at least it elicits a response in them, and whether through anger or whether through curiosity or whether through actual agreement and desire, they pick up the telephone and they call us. And we don't have an 800 number, so at least it costs them for the telephone call. But then if you look at all the other costs that we incur, I was just telling Tony I'm about ready to give him another booklet, should have it to my son Matthew for laying out and design and all of that on Monday or at the latest Tuesday on the Mark of the Beast. It's been a complete thorough rewrite, goes all the way through what is the beast, what is the image of the beast, what is the mark of the beast, and all the prophecies that are relevant to it. It'll be a substantial booklet. And we are paying, I think, somewhere just under $3,000 for every booklet that we print. We haven't cranked in the very large postage costs, and you know postage is going up. We're paying 32 cents just for a letter to be mailed out, but we're also paying a few dollars for each one of the audio tapes and the videotapes that are going out, all free of charge. I don't have to tell you that you know we never pass the hat or take up collections or anything like that at our local church services. We only do on the 7 annual holy days when God commands it. But that's the way God's work grows. I've been kidding and joking a little bit with my wife. I've noticed that the Texas lottery is up between, I think, 7 to 10 million. So if one of you come up with the right number, will you promise to tithe? I'll tell you what, if God wanted to do that, I don't think God works that way. I don't think any of us think that. God doesn't mess with lotteries or, you know, tell an angel to kind of stack the marbles or however it's done. But you got about one chance in a trillion, whatever it is. Same chance you've got of sitting in your living room and being struck by lightning, I understand. But in any event, God will get the work done. The next issue of World Watch is at least in preparation. It's going to be a little while. We just mailed out the last one. And very shortly, I'll be on the next issue of the newspaper and try to have a lot of pictures and information, including maps, about the Feast of Tabernacles. I don't have the latest statistics, but I think it is nudging toward 1,000 in the aggregate, and we can give those, we can print those when we have them, but people are, I think it's over 350 going toward 400 expected up at Branson, and I think it is around 600 and some, I'm not sure of the statistics right now, I haven't talked to Gene in the last few days, that are planning to come out down to Panama City Beach, and I know it's over 150 going toward 200 planning to come up to Tahoe. As it stands now, Shirley and I are going to hope to join the majority of our family down at Panama City Beach and be there for the first two sermons, maybe three, then go up to Branson for 2 days, then go to Tahoe for 2 days, then double back and be for the last great day at Panama City Beach again. That's because it'll be the largest feast site with the largest number of people. And I know I'd like to be at all of the sites, God willing, if I can. And I think the people would appreciate that, so they don't just have to have tapes. We'll have a lot of ministers at each place. Mr. Phil Dunnigan, who is area coordinator for the entire western third of the country out in Albuquerque, will be the festival coordinator, festival elder, I've always called him, but festival coordinator for the Tahoe site. And Dr. James Ricks will be the festival coordinator for the Branson, the Kimberling Inn site near Branson. And Mr. Tom Carey, who is the pastor of our very large 100-plus congregation down in New Orleans, will be the coordinator for the feast site down at Panama City. He's planning on making a preliminary visit over there very shortly, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to do that to get down there in advance, but I would sure love to. Somebody's got to do it. You know. May as well be me. I mean, somebody's got to look into these things. You know, in these songs, and this was a particularly arousing song service, I thought, today, with the beat and the music and the enthusiasm that everybody put into it. And in the opening prayer, we talk about praising God and worshiping God. I think you never really appreciate how good you feel until you're sick. And I know the last couple of weeks after that vicious air conditioning got me up in Jackson, Michigan, and having a head cold and a sinus problem, then it goes down to the esophagus, and you got a deep cough, and it comes back up into your sinus, and you got that, and I've been coughing most of the morning, and suddenly I get to speaking, and I don't cough anymore. I hope I don't. You forget to thank God when you feel really good and really wonderful. We were hearing a very sad story recently about a friend that we know who became embroiled in a very, very ugly divorce. And about the very same time, the firm that he worked for was having terrible troubles, and about the same time he found out that he had melanoma, some kind of a cancer to deal with on his skin. And I was telling the gentleman who told me this that on the stress level that they used to report, I read once in Reader's Digest, they say that losing your job is a stress of X, and divorce is a stress of Y, and then maybe moving to a different location is stressful, and something happening like sickness or a death in the family. And they had a scale of like whatever, 1 to 100. And some of these situations just push you right on out of the top of the scale. And then I see what is happening in Japan, and believe it or not, because of the collapse of the Japanese economy, not total collapse, but a real slide into depression over there, tremendous number of suicides. The Japanese believe in that. They believe in harakiri, they call it, in World War II. Lots of Japanese businessmen are jumping out of windows and falling on their swords these days because they just can't stand the loss of material possessions. You know, deliverance from God, deliverance from sickness, disease, debility, aches and pains, and then when you feel well, I think you ought to just thank God and praise God and get on your knees and every single morning, noon, and night, thank Him that you feel good. I was certainly thankful in many cases recently to God for all that He has done in this work. Very, very thankful when I see what people are willing to give that we can have to give the Word and to get a work really going that is beginning to become significant once again. And very, very grateful and thankful for the many, many letters that we receive. I didn't want to work hard, but I did want to at least answer a few of them, and that's enjoyable for me. So I dictated about 7 answers this morning to some wonderful letters that came in. One from up in Nanaimo on the island of Vancouver Island, British Columbia, and other parts of the country, and to see what people are saying and thinking. One dear old lady that had a terrible problem with her foot, 13-year-old granddaughter having to have a back operation, a dear friend of 50 years having to have her third back operation, this lady with all kinds of aches and pains. And you know, you can say time and again, there but for the grace of God go I. Or you really can't understand what other people endure until you've, as they say, walked a mile in His shoes. It doesn't matter what problems, trials, or troubles you have in your life, you can look around and you can find somebody without too much difficulty that's having an awful lot, horrible, worse time than you are. I want to turn to the 103rd and then the 107th Psalm. I've been reading a lot of the Psalms, and I've done that now for about 3 years, a little more than I had previously, and made a lot of the Psalms my prayer from time to time, on my knees and reciting some of David's beautiful Psalms, which, you know, were inspired to music. And David Actually, there are several books in the Psalms, and one whole book of the Psalm, Book 5, is devoted to praise toward God. There is one from Solomon, surrounded by two from David on either side, and 13 by King Hezekiah, believe it or not. There are many of the Psalms that are written by others than David. But this 103rd Psalm is a Psalm from David. My father used to love to quote these scriptures, and I think they are absolutely beautiful. It's like a sermon in itself. Bless the Eternal, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless His holy name. One of the letters I received that I just answered this morning said, well, what is His name? What is the name of God? Shall we just refer to God, or does God have a name? Now, obviously, this person knew very little about the Bible. So I went through in the letter about how when Moses was seeing the phenomenon of the burning bush, he said, when I go and I talk to these people in Egypt, and what will I say unto them? Who sent me to them? Who will I say you are? And in the ancient Hebrew, not the modern Hebrew of today, came the statement, I am that I am. Say unto them, I am has sent you. Now in English, we wonder, what does that mean? Well, it means really, I will be that which I will be. I am the ever-living one. I am the one who was and is to come. I am the eternal. You know, you can say, I am. And we can now get into a deep philosophical argument about whether or not that is true. You'd be amazed looking into etymology and the derivation of various English words and the various words in the Greek, the Hebrew, and finally into the Latin, and then the High German, and the Grosse Deutsch, and so on, that came down into the very corrupt language that we look at back in the 16th century, that we don't even recognize, that was really Old English, and into this English tongue of ours, about the infinity of to be. Well, you remember the old statement, to be or not to be, that is a question? Some people will argue, I'm not really here. This is merely a transitory experience. It's only a phase. I was here before, I'm here now, but I'm going to be here again in a different form. And believe it or not, you can read a lot of philosophical books about the state of being of even human life, and people aren't really convinced of what it is. God has many names in the Bible. The very first word for God, found in the first chapter of Genesis in verse 1, is Elohim. And I think all of you are educated to the Bible, and you know that. It's a plural word that means more than one. He is Yah, He is El, He is Eloah, He is Yahweh, or Yahvah, or Jehovah, or Yahweh. We don't know exactly how to pronounce it. Some people who think they know how to pronounce it and call it Jehovah call themselves Jehovah's Witnesses. Other people in the sacred names movement believe we should say, however they say it, I'm not sure how they say it, Yahweh, or Yahweh. And there is a society of Yahweh that is their actual corporate name. And they believe we should lapse into Hebrew. Now, to give you a clue, you can disprove that very quickly just by reading the second chapter of the book of Acts. At least 15 different languages, 15 different dialects, were hearing one by one 12 men whose hair appeared to be on fire talking about, now we read in English, but it came to us from the Greek, the wonderful works of God. But when the disciples, or the apostles, with their flaming hair, were recounting what had occurred during their 3.5 years with Jesus Christ and His death, His burial, and His resurrection, they were using the common name that they spoke, which was either Hebrew, most likely, Greek, least likely, or Aramaic, second most likely, their native tongue. Remember how Peter and James and John and some of them were accused of the Pharisees down in Jerusalem of being unlearned men because they were Galileans? Well, the Galileans had a dialect, or an accent rather, just like Texans speak differently than New Yorkers. And they were recognized by their speech. These men spoke in their own natural speech about the marvelous works of God, but God translated it immediately, and these people understood it, and obviously, if God translated the communication miraculously, the gift of speaking as well as hearing, while the words were yet in the air, to reach the minds of 15 different representatives of 15 different languages and dialects, they heard a word that in their language meant God. They didn't hear some strange Hebrew word that they look around and say, what's that mean? Because the point of the miracle of Pentecost was to reach those human minds through the miracle of both speaking and hearing that God gave on that occasion. God's name, as David praised God, is Jehovah Nissi, God my banner or my shield. He called him God my high fortress, God my hiding place, God my savior, God who gives me life, the life giver, God who is our healer, Yahweh Rophika. There are so many of those, believe it or not, in the 23rd Psalm. There are several different titles of God if you look up the original Hebrew and see the references to God. And if you look into Bullinger's Companion Bible, and the Oxford King James English has a whole section in the back of it by the Concordance called Divine Names and Titles. And you could spend hours just contemplating the various divine attributes of God, that He is all-merciful, He is all-knowing, He is forgiving, He is everywhere present. In Him we live and move and have our being. He gives us the air that oxygenates our bloodstream. And you can just ponder life, the state of being, what life is all about, and how wonderful it is when you feel good and are counting your blessings. Bless the Eternal, O my soul. And sometimes I say when I'm praying to God, who am I to bless you? I need you to bless me. But He means that praise to God and appreciation toward God and all that is within me with my strength and my mind. Bless His holy name. Bless the Eternal, O my soul, and forget not all His benefits. The benefits of God that I think about are, first of all, life. Secondly, loved ones, family. Thirdly, food, clothing, and shelter, sustenance, the ability to enjoy that love and that family and that life. And then, of course, immediately, absence of disease, absence of aches and pains, absence of fear and worry, protection from enemies from without, peace and tranquility. Just for the fun of it, I decided today to reread the Constitution of the United States and to reread the Gettysburg Address and to reread the amendments to the Constitution. And no wonder the Mormons think that those are sacred documents. If you want to know what they say, just pick up an almanac because all of that information is in there and read it. And some of it is absolutely so moving of what the Founding Fathers decided to put down in pen and ink, and the people who crafted the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States, and the wonderful freedoms that we enjoy. Now, we're about to celebrate our nation's birthday on July the 4th. What is that, only 2 weeks away? I think only 2 weeks away, and we're going to celebrate the birthday of this great free nation of ours that is fraught with all kinds of difficulties. But you don't know of a better place to live in spite of all those difficulties. Somebody might want to run away to Australia and say it's better, but they've got their drugs and they've got their crime and they've got their droughts and floods and famines and difficulties down there as well. And truly, among all the defective governments on earth, the United States is still the very best for all of its flaws. You know, in most countries of the world, you can't do what we can do here. I can go in my home right now, if I wanted to tomorrow, and load up a rifle or two or three, a pistol if I wanted, and I can drive across Texas to Colorado, and I can go through part of Oklahoma or part of New Mexico, and I can go up there and take those guns out. I will not be stopped at any bridge. I will not be stopped at any entry into a city or near any complex or near any Air Force base, like up at maybe Wichita Falls. I won't be stopped by anybody for any means to search me or to find out what am I doing with those guns. And as long as I've got a license that I buy over the table when I get to Colorado, I can go up there and hunt on public land that is paid for by the taxpayers of the United States, millions and millions of acres, BLM, and hunt deer or elk or antelope and do it in perfect freedom. You can't do that in England or Scotland. All the game belongs to the Queen. You can't do that today in Kosovo or anywhere in Yugoslavia. You can't do that in most of Europe. You can't do it even in the state of Texas, because all land is privately held and people will lease a deer hunt for $1,000 a month or year or whatever, or several hundred dollars a month, or it will cost you several thousand dollars to go down to the maybe Webb County or Zapata County, and what they call the Muy Grande counties down along the border with Mexico to go deer hunting, but you can't do it very, very cheaply, and it's on private land. Freedoms like that are enjoyed almost uniquely by Americans, and to a large extent by Canadians. Fantastic benefits and blessings for living in the United States of America. And I never tire of thanking God that I'm an American, that I was born here, and that I grew up during the time of World War II, and that I grew up on an Oregon farm part-time, and that in my early days I was actually able to plow and to rake and to harrow and to scythe or to cut hay and to stack hay and to mow hay and to do all of that behind horses. And that we didn't have any indoor facilities. And I read books by an old coal oil lantern. And my brother and I played button, who's got the button. And sometimes when one would vacate the room, the other would go hide it in Grandma's hair. And she would be sitting there in her rocker. And we would say, "You're getting close. You're so close a snake will bite you." And we had simple little games during those days. Then we could tune into the old B battery radio set and kind of chase it around and try to hear Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Or maybe we could hear Gangbusters, and later on Red Skelton came on when I was still a teenager. It was a simple way of life. But as I remember that Oregon farm going out, I got to tell you a very embarrassing story, but it's only a part of one chapter of a book I wrote that someday I hope to get published called You Can't Milk Cows and Play the Violin. And the reason I wrote that book is because my Uncle Dwight was a concert violinist, the first violinist in the Portland Symphony, when he had to come home when his father died to stay with his now widowed mother and give up that and, of course, get out. And when you're trying to bend stiff whang leather in an Oregon winter around a couple of recalcitrant horses, it does terrible things to your knuckles and your hands. And when you're milking four cows every morning at 5:30, that does terrible things to your hands. So when you grow these calluses and your knuckles are real stiff, you can't milk cows and play the violin. And all the things that Dwight did and all of his inventions and everything are in that book. But one time they got a box of little yellow peeping chicks from Montgomery Ward, and they were delivered by the postman, and I brought them to the house, and Grandma put them in a little wire cage out by the orchard. She had all kinds of different trees, nuts, and everything. I began to let those little chickens, when they could wander around, walk underneath boards, and I would take the old planks that we'd used to walk on, and I would open them up, and the chickens would run under there, and they would see those little sow bugs and all kinds of crickets and some worms and everything, and they'd just busily peck. Well, as they began to grow and they got the little white wings and kind of shed their yellow, I was like the Pied Piper to those chickens. Daily walks I would take with those chickens. I'd go out and here's a whole herd of chickens following me around. Well, I was a little kid. I was about Michael's age, maybe a little younger. And one day I'd run out of planks and chips and cow chips and stuff, the rocks to pick up and let the chickens look under. There weren't any more bugs. They'd eaten them all. And so here was a big 55-gallon drum. But it was kind of greasy on the top, and it rains a lot in Oregon. It rained recently. There was a little bit of rain on the top. You know, it has a big lip on it. And I was a little old kid, so I got my arms around that drum, and I thought there's got to be a lot of worms under there. So I got that drum, and I pulled it up about that far, and the chickens rushed under it, and it slipped out of my grasp and went swish. Yeah, boy. And I looked, and the flock had been rather seriously diminished. It wasn't the whole flock, but some of them were not quite as eager to get under there, but a bunch of them had run under there. I couldn't bear to look under that thing. There was no way I was going to look under to count the bodies. So I just nonchalantly took them back to their pen, and they followed me back there. And I closed the little wire gate there on the pen, and I just kind of went about my business thinking I was in terrible trouble. Could imagine what Grandpa and Dwight were going to say. When, to my very great pleasure that afternoon, Dwight happened to see, and I saw it, we were coming back from the milking, and here was, they had a bobtail cat. They had about five or six cats that would, you know, be around the barn to catch mice. And here went this bobtail cat with one of those chickens in its mouth. The next day, Dwight shot the cat, and that was the end of that story. And I wrote that in a book because I said, when it comes right down to it, it's, you know, between me and the cat, it's going to be the cat every time. And but I couldn't help it. I wasn't going to go and tell that story. And my grandmother lived to be 96 and a half, and she's gone. And I never did tell her what happened to the rest of those chickens. They thought the cat had eaten every one of them. Forget not all of his benefits. who forgiveth all thine iniquities. Now, when you think of that, what an incredible statement. Back in the book of Hebrews, I will be merciful unto their iniquities and their sins, and I will remember them no more at all. He doesn't need to be that kind of a God. He could be a God that demands a little finger for a small sin and a larger finger for a bigger sin and your whole hand for a major one, couldn't he? If he wanted to be, he has all power. God could demand of us full measure, full penalty for every rotten little thought or deed we commit. But instead he says what he wants is for our heart to break. And for our spirit, instead of being proud and prideful and boastful and supercilious and vain, to be humble and contrite. And as he says, a humble and contrite spirit thou wilt not despise, O Lord. And to be cast down. Moses was the meekest man on the earth at that time, yet saddled with the greatest responsibility. But he was not proud. He was the meekest among all men. Christ said that I am meek and lowly. And he said, come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, for I will give you rest. And he was a man of sorrows, it says in Isaiah 52:3, that he bore our transgressions. And when you think that here is your greatest champion, the greatest man who ever lived, the smartest man, the most, I think, perfectly formed man. He wasn't handsome as we would count male physiognomy or faces today, probably, because the Bible said when we would see him, there is nothing that we would desire if we just saw him. He looked average and ordinary. But he had to have a flawless, perfect body because there was not a single deformity or blemish. The lamb that signified Christ was to be an unblemished lamb. Here was the greatest man who ever lived, who had even his thoughts in subjection to God, and prayed until the sweat, as it were, bursting capillaries, would drip down his forehead, would get up out of his bedclothes at 3 o'clock in the morning and before, and be up on a mountain praying, almost agonizing with God in prayer, and his disciples would find him there. And you read the story of the life of Jesus Christ and how great he is, and to think of these people you see on television every day, the fellow just yesterday given 2 life sentences and about 3 or 4 other 20-year sentences, which is ludicrous, but he's going to be in for life, in other words, for killing his own mother and killing several classmates and gunning down and injuring many, many more over in some other southwestern state, I think, I forget. And then, of course, the kids who have recently attacked schools and shot up school children and everything. It says that for a good man, perhaps one would die. And I remember many cases, not just one, in World War II, one in particular I remember from Guadalcanal, where suddenly, just on impulse, because of the deep attachment that men in battle will form for each other, without even thinking, a Japanese grenade came into a foxhole where a group of men were, and a man just grabbed it, clasped it up here, and threw himself on the ground and took the full blast and died instantly to shield his buddies. So the Apostle Paul wrote that perhaps for a good man one would die, but while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, the godly for the ungodly. And as I preached on Pentecost, I wasn't here for that, but I think I referred to it to you in the previous Sabbath. God's mercy went first of all to the murderers of his son. On Pentecost, in the audience, according to what Peter said, you by wicked hands have taken and killed. And he went right through how, reminding them, some of them have been out there on the Gabbatha with their staves and stamping and this riotous mob saying, crucify him, crucify him, in a chant. They were in Peter's and Paul, in Peter's and the other disciples' audience on the day of Pentecost. And when they said, men and brethren, what shall we do? And they were stricken. Repent and be baptized, and you shall receive the Holy Spirit of God. The Holy Spirit of God was offered, first of all, to the killers of Christ. Now that says something about the love and the mercy of God beyond our human ability to relate to equate. Because the last person in the world you would want to forgive is someone who killed your own son. Someone who killed somebody else's son, that's a philosophical thing for you. But somebody that killed your son, that close to you, how merciful would we feel? And that shows how different and how great is God and his love and mercy compared to we struggling human beings, who forgiveth all thine iniquities, who healeth all thy diseases, who redeemeth thy life from destruction. Now, I don't want to read all of this, but who crowneth thee with loving kindness and tender mercies. With this thought of redeeming your life from destruction, I want you to turn to the 107th Psalm. And as you're turning there, let me relate something. I don't know whether God had a hand in saving my father and mother's life and whether Satan the devil had a hand in trying to take it. But I do remember very well several different occasions, one of which was on a very slick Oregon road up near Oregon City one time, and I was in the car. There was a big flatbed truck and another vehicle, and I forget, my father wrote this in some detail, I believe, in his autobiography. But he always felt that something had actually jerked the steering wheel out of his hand because he didn't know how he got through there. He started to skid. There was no room for a car to even get through this aperture with this big flatbed truck projecting out into the roadway with my mother and his children in the back seat. But he barely went through with about probably a half inch to spare on either side and escaped what could have been a disastrous automobile crash. My mother told a story, and I have no reason at all to doubt it. Way before I was born, when my sister Beverly, who was 12 years older than I, was a little bitty baby, not even able to walk, probably only a few months old, and was propped up by the head of the bed, by the bedstead, and some pillows, and we just as you will, put a little baby in the middle of the bed and put pillows around it so it can't roll off. Well, over back of the bed was a very large framed picture, a very heavy old picture frame, the old wooden type that they used to have. My mother told for years that she heard an audible voice, and I have no reason to doubt it. Was it in her mind only, or would somebody else have heard it if they were near? Move Beverly. She was lying there drowsily sleeping, I think, and napping. Move Beverly. It said it about three times. On that intuition, she got up and she moved the baby. And just after she did, that picture frame came crashing down right where the baby's head had been. When my parents were coming back from a trip to Europe in 1947 and still saw an awful lot of the devastation over there, they were on the Queen Mary. The Queen Mary got caught in a hurricane. It was out in the mid-Atlantic, and all of the corridors that were shut and were battened down. He wasn't supposed to be there, but my dad went up to the aft portion and got out to where he could actually step out barely in that gale and to see the waves. They were over 60 feet tall. Gargantuan rollers to where the Queen Mary was barely having steerage way, going down and up like this, just like a huge roller coaster ride. I've got film of it. I have it in a family film. My father had an 11 millimeter wound up, you know, the old kind of movie camera. And we have that on videotape of all of the old family films. We put them all together, some of my sister's kids when they were little, and one of me when I was 16 at my grandmother's 80th birthday and so on. But here were the pictures that he took of this incredible storm. And he wrote later he didn't know how that ship, as big as it was, survived because it was just like a little canoe out there. And barely, if it had been sideways or quartering into those waves, it literally would have rolled over. It would have sunk. There was no way to even keep that big ocean liner afloat with waves that huge, with the tops being just thrashed by the wind. So I know something from my lifetime and from the experience of other people about deliverance, about being delivered from troubles and trials and near escapes from death. I'll tell you a quick story. I am only here because I learned to fly a float plane. And when I got my seaplane rating, I flew many different float planes, probably a dozen or so over many, many years, and I owned one for a while that I had up at Orr, Minnesota. And when you get on a smooth lake and you get right to the speed where you're to take off, the friction of the water, it's almost like it just is holding those pontoons on the lake. If it's a little bit of a rough lake, it breaks that up. A little bit of a ripple you can take off real quickly. But on a real smooth, glassy lake, it's very difficult. So you learn the technique of taking the yoke and you go like that, put this wing down and just pick that left pontoon up out of the water and it kind of lurches sideways. You get a little beep, 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 which is a stall warning. And you've got the lever there in those old 180s for your flaps. And you work the flaps a little bit and you're off and you're flying. Nothing dangerous about it. It's merely a technique to lift one of the floats out of the water so that you reduce that drag and then the aircraft is able to fly rather than just going for miles with getting up more and more and more speed and stressing the engine out. As soon as you reach flying speed, pick up the pontoon. Now we flash forward to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And we were on the ground, my wife and a group of us, the Thornhills and others, and Dan and I were in the cockpit of the Falcon jet, and Frank, I think, was in the jump seat. We were what's called EPER set and temperature limited. We would always baby our engines. We would set them at an external pressure ratio, and we had a chart that told us exactly what that was, so that we would be less than the absolute red line temperature on those GE jet engines. And the people were talking and talking. We were saying, look, we got to go because it was snowing. They had just plowed the airport, but it was snowing, and it was heavy, sticky snow, and it was coming down. I mean, just a blinding blanket of snow, and we were going to take off. Well, it was about a 4,000-foot runway, and at the approach end of it, the opposite end, where we were going to go toward it, it just dropped straight off, and there were these huge, big stanchions painted red for the ILS system, all of them huge, big, red ones on the other end. We started to roll, and I was always calling out the speed because I was the co-pilot, and Dan was the pilot. When we got to be about 121 knots, we would be V1, rotate, fly. But at 80 knots, we were just going along, and I was saying 80 knots, 80 knots, 80 knots, and the airplane was shuddering. It had two little bitty wheels on the nose wheel, and it was just sticking, and that snow was piling up in front of it as we were roaring down the airstrip there, and it wasn't coming unstuck from that airport, from the tarmac there. And I began seeing that we were running out of space. And I said, rotate, Dan, rotate. And Dan was just like this on the wheel, and I just grabbed it, and it went like that, and cranked it all the way to stop, boom, and pulled back a little bit at the same time. Jerked that left main out of that snow and raised the nose wheel up just a little bit, and suddenly it began to gather a whole lot of speed and kind of bounce a couple on the right wheel and fly. We went in that snowstorm. We got out of 5,000 feet, and Dan said, gear up. Normally, just barely after you lift off, the pilot says, gear up, and the co-pilot moves the handle. We were through 5,000 feet before either one of us said a word. We had a full load of kerosene. If 1 second more, 1 second, 2 seconds, I don't know, we had delayed. Dan somehow didn't think to do that. If I had not known, almost intuitively, how to unstick the left side of that airplane because of flying a float plane, I would have died, and so would my family back in Hershey, Pennsylvania in the 1970s. I know what it's like to be very, very close to death. One more story and I'll quit. My wife and I were going up to Tahoe one time in my 310, a twin 310. And she didn't always like to ride in the front, and we had six seats. So she got in the middle seat in the back, and I'm up in the pilot seat, and we're just the two of us together. And I was up over the mountains above Bakersfield going, you know, the way the mountain range is there in California. And I'd put it on autopilot, and I looked down because I always would burn my auxiliary fuel and get the tip tanks empty before I'd go back to the main tanks for my landing and so on. So I reached down like that to move the fuel selector, and as I did, I looked out the right window, and there, right in my window, was the front end of a little single-engine aircraft that probably was about 6 or 8 feet from my face. It was going just like this. Went, I don't know if we missed that thing by a foot or 2 feet or 3 feet, but it was, he was exactly on the same altitude. It's only the little difference in two altimeters as to why we didn't just disappear in a big orange flash in the middle of the sky. And it took a few seconds for that to really hit me. And then I got pretty upset, and so I called Los Angeles Center and asked them, because I was on radar. I was on positive radar and was, as they said, squawking, and it's a transponder term, an identifying signal that they could read. And I asked him, had they seen any? And I know the guy lied, because he had to. He said, no, he didn't even see a primary target. Well, he had to see a primary target, because that's why I was on radar. I was flying on instruments, even though it was clear. That's enough of the stories. But when you've come that close, and you know that you had God's protection, and that you were delivered, and you were saved, because you begin to think maybe God has something in mind for you to do, or else maybe you wouldn't be here. And maybe something would have occurred to where you couldn't even be alive today. I think that this is a beautiful psalm about that. Oh, give thanks unto the Eternal, for He is good, for His mercy endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Eternal say so, whom he has redeemed from the hand of the enemy. And our enemy is Satan, the devil, and whether we're talking about warfare in Israel, as David would certainly want to pray, or whether we're talking about personal enemies, or whether we're talking about financial difficulty, or physical debility, or disease, and gathered them out of the lands from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south. They wandered in the wilderness in a solitary way. They found no city to dwell in. This is harking back to Sinai, no doubt. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted in them. Then they cried unto the Eternal in their trouble, and he delivered them out of their distresses. And he led them forth by the right way, that they might go to a city of habitation. Oh, that men would praise the Eternal for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men. Do you remember the story of Eddie Rickenbacker? Many of you heard about that during World War II. I've really forgotten how many men were on that raft, but they went down at sea way out in the middle of the South Pacific. Days and days went by. They were so emaciated that they were near death. And in other cases, you've actually heard of cases of cannibalism, cases of murder and cannibalism, and so on, of people who will do almost anything to preserve life. These men were very perilously close to that state of mind. They prayed together, and I found that a lot of cases where there are shipwrecks and people in plane crashes that are marooned in mountains or are out on a life raft in the ocean, they will pray unabashedly together. And they did. And while they were praying, an albatross landed on Rickenbacker's head. And he reached up, and it's an unclean bird. It's an unclean bird. He reached up very slowly with his hand and grabbed the legs of that big bird. And they even drank its blood and ate every shred of it, divided it up between them, and it sustained life until they were found. And that's the only reason that they survived that experience. Now, we could argue all day long, did God send that bird? I have opinions. I think he did, but that's just my opinion. For he satisfieth the longing soul and fills the hungry soul with goodness. Now, I don't know how often you get hungry. I miss a lunch or I miss a breakfast now and then, and sometimes I'll only eat two meals in a day. But when I'm fasting, I get really hungry. And I don't know that I've ever fasted more than 2 days my entire life. That's a terrible admission, I guess. I think you're supposed to admit to fasting a week or 10 days or 40 days, but I haven't done that. I do know that the world's worst time for me to get in a pulpit and tell a joke is on the Day of Atonement. Because people in that audience are sitting there and their faces are ashen gray. And there is just no ability to laugh. You know, isn't it amazing how much a glass of good wine and a good steak and a baked potato and a good salad in a nice restaurant with a good decor, with a good environment, among good friends, will bring out good cheer and will make your heart mellow. It talks about the use of wine even to him that perishes. Give strong drink to him that perishes or is of a heavy heart, it says in the Bible. And that Jesus Christ drank wine, and enough so in public, not that he drank many, many glasses at a time, but had been seen time and again, that they called him a wine bibber or a drunkard. But a glass of wine and drinking something like that at the Feast of Tabernacles with good friends and having cheer and camaraderie and telling wonderful stories and jokes and so on is what it's all about. It says he satisfies the longing soul and fills the hungry soul with goodness. And every time you bend your head and ask God's blessing on food and understand where food really comes from and that God makes it, not man who packages it and puts a lot of additives into it and puts a lot of preservatives into it and so on, but that it comes from God. Milk still comes from cows, not plastic packages or bottles or cans. Such as sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, being bound in affliction and iron. Now we're talking about people in jail, people in prison. Now I could go back and we could talk about the apostles being thrown in jail and the angel coming and actually causing the jail cell door to open and them telling the Roman soldier, no, no, don't kill yourself. It's all right. You're going to be all right. And about an earthquake that caused the jail cell doors to open on one occasion for Peter. But I have never been in prison, thanks be to the Eternal God. But I just answered a letter this morning from a man who is. And we have a lot of men on our mailing list, mostly men. I don't think we have any women prisoners who are in prison. I once did several television programs in maximum security prisons in California, both women's and men's. I sat on the grass and talked to about seven women, interviewing them, one of whom had stabbed to death three of her children. So I know what that life is like by visiting inside those prisons and seeing the way they live and what it must be like to be locked up like an animal for the rest of your life. And if you can understand that feeling, there's another story I'll tell you in a moment. Perhaps it will help. Sitting in darkness, that is solitary confinement with no light. That's why I have great respect for one of our senators who is going to run for president. I don't know why his name slips my mind at this moment, but he is quite prominent and well known. But he was like a 5-year prisoner in Vietnam in the famed Hanoi Hilton. And 5 years out of your life in a prison as a prisoner of war, lying on nothing but concrete, your feet in stocks, and being beaten by the guards and fed almost no reasonable food is a pretty horrible, traumatic thing. You can only imagine in the mind of someone who would experience that what they would feel like on the day they are free. Now my story. You've probably seen the pictures, and recently there was a documentary where I saw some of the pictures that I recalled from the earliest ones that I'd seen in the late 1940s of how those prisoners in some of the camps that Hitler had established in Poland and all over Eastern Europe felt when the GIs came in and opened those gates and rescued them. They were like walking scarecrows, like skin and bones, and some of those men could not even realize. They just looked dumbly at what was happening. But on some occasions, they would actually, on their knees, grab the muddy boots and pants legs of those soldiers and just weep and thank them for coming. And here were just stacks of bodies and open trenches with bodies and thousands of dead people all over the place, stacked like cordwood. I saw that again not 2 weeks ago, where some of those same pictures were shown on a television documentary. You can only understand this part of this psalm in the mind's eye of someone who had suffered that. I don't know if I've got claustrophobia or not. I've never tried it. I know I've been down in the magazines in the bowels of an aircraft carrier in very tight quarters, sleeping on 2,000-pound bombs, but I don't know if I have claustrophobia or not. But being in a very small cell, sitting in darkness, in the shadow of death, under sentence of death, being bound in affliction and iron, because they rebelled against the words of God and condemned or held of no estate the counsel of the Most High, therefore he brought down their heart with labor, they fell down, and there was none to help. Then they cried unto the Eternal, their God, in their trouble, and he saved them out of their distresses. There's something else that isn't said here. Most of the time, they don't cry out to God until they are in such deep trouble it looks like there's no hope. And that is another lesson of this psalm. He brought them out of darkness, now they're in the light, and out of the shadow of death, and break their bands in sunder. Oh, that men would praise the Eternal for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men. And if we would do that before we get into a situation which might lead to solitary confinement under sentence of death or to terrible physical debility or pain or something else, that is what it's all about. For he has broken the gates of brass and cut the bars of iron in sunder. Fools, because of their transgression and because of their iniquities, are afflicted. Their soul abhors all matter of meat. They draw near to the gates of death. Then they cry unto the Eternal in their trouble, and he saves them from their distresses. People make foolish decisions. People make stupid mistakes. I know all about that. They draw near unto the gates of death. It says their soul abhors all manner of meat. And I can tell you that deep distress and terrible pressure, and they call it stress, they just put that one word on it, it can literally kill people. It can kill you. It can cause strokes. It can cause heart attacks. It can cause you to lose meals, to have sudden weight loss. It can cause all kinds of problems, mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual. And it is a lack of faith and a lack of courage, a lack of positive feelings that everything is going to work out all right, but I know what it's like to go through it, because life sometimes is a series of peaks and valleys. And when you're in the valley, You just can't wait to get to the next peak. Maybe it's because that particular valley is to prepare you for the next valley, which is going to even be a little deeper. I don't know. But life is a series of peaks and valleys, as we all know. When we're up on the peak, when we're on the top, is when we ought to be giving thanks to God that we're not in the valley, and really to praise His name and thank Him so much for the great goodness that He gives us. Then they cry to the Eternal in their trouble, and He saves them out of their distresses. He sent His word and healed them and delivered them from their destructions. Oh, that men would praise the Eternal for His goodness. If you look up the Hebrew word, as I did this morning, it means His graciousness or His grace, which actually has to do with His pardon and His mercy. That He is a good, meaning a merciful, gracious God, not a harsh, unresilient, judgmental, contentious God, but a gracious, merciful God. Oh, that men would praise the Eternal for His goodness and for His wonderful works to the children of men. I once in my entire lifetime, and I won't do it here to embarrass anybody, at the Squaw Valley Feast of Tabernacles with about, 7,000 or 8,000 people there, was preaching a sermon, and I asked everyone to join in one shout, and we all just said in unison, praise God. I sometimes think, as my father did, that because of the Pentecostal movement in the United States and because of a lot of that you see on television and what a lot of people call praise worship, and you see people doing this and singing and holding hands and crying and everything, that we have tended to shy away from that and perhaps tend to go to an opposite extreme. And we should not have either extreme. We should not flaunt our spirituality, and we should not display it, but neither should we conceal it. It should be natural and easy, but it should be there so that we're not ashamed to say, praise God and thanks be to God, or bless His heart, or other expressions just because other people use them. My father felt the same way. He told me one time, I'd come into his bedroom when he was very, very ill and near death, and he had been watching one of these programs. He kind of surfed television on Sunday morning too. And he was saying, you know, Ted, sometimes I think some of these people have a certain ingredient that we're missing. And I said, I know what you mean, Dad. I agree 100%. Now, I'm not going to do that here. I think that the time that we do that is in our song service. And I think that's why a song service is so essential to fellowship and to God's churches and so on. And that God wrote all of these things to music. And they were set to music and words at the same time when they were given to David and to these other people. And they were sung, not just poetry, but psalms, a song. Oh, that men, verse 21, would praise the Eternal for His goodness and for His wonderful works to the children of men. Let them sacrifice the sacrifices of thanksgiving. Did you ever think of thanksgiving, giving God thanks, as a sacrifice? That is a pleasant sacrifice to God. I'll tell you one thing. I know that when you are really congratulated for a job well done, it makes you feel good. I was once given a commendation from the Admiral of the 11th Naval District for a particular report that I wrote and the interviews that I conducted after an accident that resulted in death. And I had the woman's head in my hands who had a crushed head, was bleeding from her ear after a huge Navy truck had overturned after a car smashed into it at our gate near Miramar, where I was as a boy of 19. I was so proud of that, a letter from Admiral Radford of congratulating me because I had saved the Navy a huge lawsuit, apparently, of an awful lot of money. But it made me feel so good. And there are other cases I can think of. I was so absolutely thrilled on the day that I received my type rating for the Falcon Fanjet DA-20, Dassault Brigade 20. And to be able to turn into a steep 90-degree bank and go around and go right through your own wake and to feel that and to have everything nailed down so beautifully. I probably was so sharp on that particular day, and just after a solid week of air work and so on, and to go over and get my type rating, that I don't know if I've ever felt sharper in a cockpit before or since. But it is so wonderful to have someone congratulate you for a job well done. Now, where do we get that feeling? From God. Does God enjoy praise? Does God want us to thank Him? Does God want us to love Him? Do we want Him to love us? I cannot imagine a God without a tremendous range of emotions. And I cannot imagine a Savior without a tremendous range of emotions. I don't want to belabor a thing that happened here about 6 months ago and even to refer to it necessarily, but just to say that the Jesus Christ that I believe I know was a man who could just break down and weep, even with people all around him, at the tomb of Lazarus. Oh, and it was boo-hoo. It wasn't just and a little tear here. It said Jesus wept. Didn't say he cried. Said he wept. And I think you know the meaning of that. That's audible. It's physical. It's obvious. And he was crying, a grown man, with his heart just breaking and his voice breaking and tears streaming down his face. I think that as Jesus Christ continually showed the love and the faith toward and the admiration and the awe toward God and gave him all the credit, "My Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works, and the Son does not do anything that the Father hasn't given him to do," and so on. And, "Father, I have kept thy commandments," and so on. And, "Father, I know that you hear me always, but for those that are around, I said it." And his instant communication with God, he's talking to you at one moment, then look up, and Father, and he's talking to God. And I know as I think of that, that God Almighty gave Jesus those emotions, and that God built those emotions into human beings. We all cry alike, we all laugh alike, we all sneeze alike. It doesn't matter whether you're Vietnamese, whether you are Yugoslavian, or German, or Japanese, or American, black, yellow, or white. If you go out chew, you sound the same way. If you cry, little children cry the same way. If you laugh, ha-ha, that's in Chinese, if you didn't know that I just laughed in Chinese. Ha-ha. We laugh the same way because we are human beings. And the universal language of all humankind, believe it or not, is music. You learn a lot about people by their music, and I could get off into this for the next hour and a half and talk about the times I've been to the Middle East and Arab music. Or I could talk about Chinese music. Or I could talk about the music that came out of Africa. Or I could talk about modern American music. And it'd be quite a subject. We could be here for hours. But you learn a lot about people because of their music. That's why I think that God maybe inspired my Uncle Dwight in some of the songs. I'm not saying all of them. But some of the beautiful music he put to the Psalms of the Bible, where he had found an actual English version which had made it into poetry. And originally there was meter and poetry in the Hebrew. And this English version, old book that he had when I was a little boy, he found, and he wrote his psalms, the songs from that. So I think that this is enough to give us a little bit of what I wanted to convey to you today. We'll go down to verse 31. We see this again. Well, let me just go to this one thing because it reminded me of what my father went through. Let's begin in verse 23. "They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, commercial sailors, these see the works of the Eternal and His wonders in the deep." Do they ever? When you get out at sea, and if you realize all the creatures that are in the sea and everything, "For He commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves thereof." No one really knows why great low pressure causes in this hemisphere the counterclockwise motion of huge clouds and so on, and of that tremendous low that is causing wind to rush in to try to fill the absence of pressure and causes a hurricane. They just know it happens. They don't know why. "They mount up to the heaven, they go down again to the depths." There's your pitching of a ship, way up here 60 feet high and then right down in the trough. "Their soul is melted because of trouble." They're afraid they're going to drown any minute. "They reel to and fro and stagger like the drunken man and are at their wit's end." I was in a hurricane off in the South China Sea that was so powerful that I was in what was called A1, the barbette of the 40-millimeter quad gun director, above the bridge on an aircraft carrier which had a deck that was 60 feet above the sea. I was probably 100 feet above the sea and I got green water in my face. We plowed into a wave so big that it actually bent some of the heavy metal around the 40-millimeter quads that were underneath the flight deck on the forward part of that ship and put them out of commission. Just staggered that aircraft carrier. I could tell you stories about World War II when a whole bunch of ships actually went down and when destroyers rolled right over on their beam ends and sunk with all hands in a hurricane. This reminds me of a hurricane, because that's what it's talking about. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man and are at their wits' end. Then they cry unto the Eternal in their trouble, and He brings them out of their distresses. He makes the storm a calm. Jesus did when they were so scared that night they thought they were going to drown right in the Sea of Galilee. And He said, "Peace, be still." And suddenly the winds quit and the lake was calm, so that the waves thereof are still. Then are they glad, because they, the waves, be quiet. So He bringeth them into their desired haven. And are you ever glad in life when God brings you to your desired haven, and the storms are past, and the clouds are gone, and you are thankful, and you give God the thanks and the praise? Oh, that men would, and I think we are willing, aren't we, praise the Eternal for His goodness and for His wonderful works to the children of men.